Okay, let's get started. Hello, everyone. My name is Urs Gasser. I'm delighted to welcome you to our panel on the EU Copyright Directive, EUCD, also known as the Information Society Directive. As you will see very soon, it's a very hot topic. We already start sweating, actually. As you can take from the conference program, this session is about the analysis and evaluation of the current European Union copyright framework or landscape as shaped in important ways by the European Union Copyright Directive and its national implementations. We are very fortunate today having with us some of Europe's foremost copyright experts and thought leaders in this space. So please welcome with me the following panelists in alphabetic order. Maya Bogataj, she's the director of the Intellectual Property Law Institute in Ljubljana, Slovenia. Bernd Hugenholz, to the far left, he's the director of the Institute for Information Law at University of Amsterdam, where he is teaching intellectual property law. Bernd and his team, we'll hear certainly more about that, are currently working on the evaluation report on the EUCD, a report, if I understand correctly, commissioned by the European Commission. Cornelia Kutter, just in time. You heard her before in the previous panel. She's a senior legal advisor at the European Consumer Organization in Brussels. Last but not least, of course, Tilman Lüder, the head of the unit Copyright and Knowledge-Based Economy with the DG Internal Markets European Commission, also from Brussels or in Brussels. Please let me start with mapping very briefly the core issues that will be covered in this in the following four presentations. We will start in a big picture and taking stock mode by asking as to what extent and in what areas the European Copyright Directive has achieved its goal to harmonize divergent copyright regimes across Europe. If it turns out, and there is some likelihood that it has failed to do so, we will explore the question, what are the reasons for this failure? Even if it's only a failure in part, we'll see. This leads us to a more fundamental question, actually, and that is the question, is harmonization in what the US Supreme Court recently has called a quicksilver technological environment possible at all? From this big picture question, we will move forward to other more specific key issues concerning the substance of the directive. We will ask questions such as, has the EUCD struck the right balance between copyright holders' interest on the one hand side and users' interests and the public's interest at large on the other hand side? But also, what is an adequate balance between exclusive rights and fair compensation, a topic Tilman will talking about? Will compensation models prevail in the age of digital distribution? From these substantive issues, we'll then move towards more process-oriented issues and questions by discussing the experiences of the new EU member states with the EUCD and its implementation transposition into national law. Questions in this particular context will be, are implementations of the European Copyright Directive by new EU member states, and also, of course, in the future by accessing and candidate countries, necessarily examples of cut-and-paste legislation? Or is there room for experiments, and is there also time to come up with alternative approaches to implementation? Or the question, can accession and candidate countries learn from the mistakes incumbent EU member states have made? And what are the lessons learned? And are there best practice models emerging or not? We will have a session tomorrow discussing that, whether if you look at the different copyright regimes across Europe that have already implemented the copyright directive, whether we can identify good and bad examples which may lead towards something like a best practice guide. Check out the wiki and please join us tomorrow in this discussion. Our panel will not only look back in this taking stock mode, though, but it will also look forward, as you will see in a few minutes. The presentations and hopefully later on also the discussion, and this session is supposed to be more interactive than the last one, will also address areas and possibilities of improvement of the current copyright framework. In other words, if we got it wrong with the EUCD, how can we improve the situation in the years to come, both at the level of European Union law as well as at the level of member state law? Another question, what are our policy options? How promising, for instance, is copyright law reform at the European level? Or shall we try to fix in other areas of law, such as consumer protection laws, what we have messed up in the area of copyright legislation, something Cornelia may be talking about a little bit, and hopefully we can continue with this conversation beyond today. And finally, what are or should be our priorities while moving forward? How can we make sure that the UCD is not only perceived as a tool for copyright tyranny, but also as a set of rules aimed at fostering user creativity, innovation, and freedom? As you can see, there's a lot on today's menu. Thus, without further ado, I would like to turn over to our first speaker, Bernd Hugenholz.
Can I briefly remove it? Yeah, I'll do that. Good afternoon. I will not be using slides today. I have more serious matter to discuss. My name is Bernd Hugenholz, and I was already introduced by Urs as one of the authors of a study for the European Commission. It's worse than that. We are actually doing two studies at the same time, one on the Information Society Directive and one on the more general issue of the recasting of copyright for the knowledge economy. You would, of course, like to hear about study number one, but we're not there yet. And that's a reason why I cannot reveal its contents as possibly Urs might have hoped. What I can do is offer you a sneak preview of the other study, the more general study on the harmonization process overall that has been taking place in Europe over the last 15 years. For me personally, I think that is a much more interesting exercise because it allows us to step back a bit and look at what this harmonization process has achieved over time and whether it is an adequate means, as Urs already queried, to respond to rapid technological change. This, in fact, has always been the idea behind, or one of the important ideas behind the harmonization processes, its response to technology. First directive was on, you may remember, if you're old enough, on computer software in 1991, and it then went on each time to respond to new technological development. Is this really the way to do it here in Europe? That's the question that I would like to put forward here, and that, of course, also reflects on our discussions on the Information Society Directive. So here's that sneak preview. I hope, Tilman, you don't really mind that I offer some very preliminary conclusion. Yeah, I will read only a few pages, don't worry. The entire thing is 220 pages, which also explains why I look a bit hollow-eyed. In fact, I have started to wear reading glasses. This is a bad sign. Okay, looking at that harmonization, at first sight, of course, it's been surprisingly productive. 7 directives on a wide range of fields carried through the European legislative machinery, from the early vertical directives dealing with software databases, rental and lending rights, satellite and cable term, to the more horizontal, more ambitious ones culminating in the Information Society Directive, or the EUCD, as we call it today, of 2001, which was really ambitious and which covered a very broad range of issues in the realm of copyright and related rights. An impressive body of harmonization at first sight. But these results, and they are there, and we cannot deny them, have come, I believe, at considerable expense, both in terms of time, public finance, and other social costs to the organs of the European community, and particularly to its member states and its citizens. Due to the complexity of the European lawmaking process, even a relatively non-controversial directive may take several years to complete from its first proposal to its final adoption, including nowadays translation into 20 official languages of the community, soon 21. And then when that is all over, and that might take a while, the whole process is repeated at the national level, nowadays at 25 member states. 25 governments will consult, again, local stakeholders, draft 25 different implementation bills, and discuss with 25 different parliaments that are often ignorant of the fact that the main decisions have, in fact, already been taken at the European level. This is not an attractive process. The step-by-step approach towards harmonization that the EU legislator has indeed followed has placed an enormous burden on the legislative apparatus of the member states. For national legislators, in fact, in most European countries, what it has meant is that they have been working on implementing almost nonstop for the last 15 years or so. And in fact, one or two legislators are still working as we speak today. If you take account of the preliminary process of policy development that precedes any directive initiative, and then you start counting until the last implementation by the last member state somewhere in the European Union, let's call it France or Spain, the whole process might take 10 years. Look at the Information Society Directive, the EUCD, which basically started in 1996, directly after the conclusion of the WIPO treaties in Geneva. Main feature of this directive was to transpose the obligations under the WIPO treaties in a uniform way for the entire European Union. And now we're in 2006, and implementation is still not complete. 10 years. 10 years to respond to rapid technological change, to the quick, silvery development in technology. That doesn't really work. In 1996, peer-to-peer file sharing was perhaps on the radar screen of only a few geeks, but certainly not an issue that any copyright scholar or legislator seriously contemplated, and there are many other examples. The responses found, whatever you think of them, the quality, whatever the side you're on, in the debate, the responses that are now implemented at the national level are responses to 10-year-old developments. But there are many other reasons, in fact, to be skeptical about the instrument of harmonization. One reason that might interest you a bit more is the asymmetric normative effect of harmonization of regulation by directive, as we call it in our study. And what we mean is that the harmonized norms of copyright and related rights in almost all cases exceed the minimum standards of the Berne and Rome Conventions, the international standards to which the member states already adhered. Protection always goes up in the course of harmonization. Not always, but in most cases. In most cases, member states have had to adopt the level of protection to a new uniform, harmonized European standard in excess of what they were used to before. And there are several reasons, of course, for this process. One, the conspiracy theory that basically the European legislator eats out of the hands of the content owners and that they do anything that the content owners want. This is, at best or at worst, only part of the story. There's, in fact, a very rational explanation for this process. If you harmonize, it is very difficult to harmonize downwards. It is very difficult to tell a member state the protection that you have today is too high. Let's lower it. You are, in fact, expropriating. You're asking for trouble, and you will not get that member state on board. So if you average out, you will always average out at the highest level. And there's always one country in Europe that has a particularly high level for a particular issue. Look at your own country. I assume most of you are from Germany. You're the ones that gave us life plus 70 in copyright. That's the worldwide norm now. Why? Because it was originally the norm in Germany, and then it became the European norm. All the other countries had life plus 50, except Spain, to a certain extent. A good example of this almost inevitable trend of upwards harmonization. That is a worrying trend. A reason, I believe, for major concern. I believe the effectiveness in both in economic and social terms and the credibility in terms of democratic support of any system of intellectual property really depends on finding that famous and delicate balance between the interest of the right holders in maximizing protection. It is a legitimate interest, and the equally legitimate interest of users, the public at large, in having access to products of creativity and knowledge. And that doesn't mean always going upwards. And there's another thing from the EU perspective. I believe it's an unhealthy development to constantly create new obstacles to the establishment of an internal market, because that is the net effect of all these growing, expanding rights. The whole idea behind harmonization was creating an internal market, not creating new obstacles. But they are, in fact, and have been created as long as these exclusive rights, becoming ever more powerful, remain largely territorial and can be exercised along the national borders of the 25 member states. This is not creating an internal market, at least not in the way I see it. And then there's another reason to think again about further harmonization. It is in its inherent limited potential, and I think Urs already alluded to it, to provide true unification of law. Harmonization directives usually leave a broad measure of discretion to the member states. They want that, and from their perspective, I understand that. And they take it, particularly when the wording of its provisions are relatively vague as a result of some European political compromise. And in some cases, the norms of a directive become so vague and leave so much leeway to the member states that their actual harmonizing effect must be seriously called into doubt. Look at Article 5, paragraph 2 and 3 of the EUCD, which has this famous list, this shopping list, as I like to call it, of 21 or 22 permitted limitations, only one of them mandatory, that's the one in 5.1. For the rest, member states can just pick and mix, choose whatever limitation they like or dislike, a smorgasbord of exceptions, not leading really to any kind of harmonization, merely leading to havoc at the national level. But assuming that we can achieve perfect harmonization, and in some areas it has been achieved. The software directive is relatively clear on a number of issues and does not allow much leeway. Even there, harmonization will never lead to completely unified norms at the European and national levels. National legislators will always interpret directives in the way they like to perceive certain conceptions, in the way they are used to interpret the norms that ring familiar bells with nationally developed doctrine and literature. They will look at the directive through the lens of their own laws and terminology. They will wishfully interpret European norms in the way they used to do it. So even if the directive is copied literally into the books of a national member state, harmonization still is not achieved. We have many examples of this homing tendency in national law, but I will spare you the details. The database directive actually provides the best ones. There is a uniform originality standard in that directive, which is mandatory upon the member states. Hardly any member state has actually implemented that. The member states all said, all agreed, this is exactly our national norm. Well, this is not true. Indeed, when one looks at the 25 copyright laws of the 25 member states, and I'm sure you have once allowed yourself a peek into the law of a neighboring member state, they look very, very different. Even the new accession states all have done their own thing. Some have perhaps looked a bit over the shoulder of the German legislator, and which has been quite influential, but they all have their own style, they all have their own look and feel, and an uninformed observer looking at these 25 copyright laws side by side, assuming you could read them all, would never guess that these are the results of 15 years of harmonization. On balance, as you may guess, we are rather skeptical of the process of harmonization. It has produced mixed results at great expense, and its beneficial effects on the internal market are limited at best. And this sobering conclusion, in our opinion, calls for extreme caution when considering future harmonization directives. In the light of the renewed interest in the EEC's legislative competence, in view of the growing importance of the principles of subsidiarity and proportionality, we respectfully advise the EC legislator not to undertake any new initiatives at harmonization, except where a really urgent need for alignment or correction of the acquis, the existing directives, can be demonstrated. Instead, and this is in line, I believe, with current European Commission policy, but Tilman can tell you more about that, various other legislative instruments appear to be much more suitable and effective to achieve the goal of achieving an internal market, especially in a dynamically developing market like the one we are discussing today. In the short run, instruments of soft law, as we call them, such as recommendations, interpretive notices, or communications, would, in our opinion, be the legislative tools of choice. Soft law is really suitable for dealing with the dynamics of an information market that is in constant flux and that regularly requires ad hoc legislative adjustment. Also, solutions in soft law might eventually serve as test beds, as experimental grounds for more permanent legislative solutions. That is our proposal for the short term. No more harmonization. Do it in soft law. Do it with soft law. In the long run, of course, we have to be a bit more ambitious than that. And what we propose for the long run, and the long run can be very long, we're scholars, so we're in no hurry. We again advise the Commission to start thinking about a truly European copyright law, not a body of harmonized copyright law, but a body of unified copyright norms, a European copyright law or code or regulation or what have you, that is binding directly upon the citizens of Europe, bypassing the member states and the national parliaments. This was long and is still by many considered a total taboo in copyright circles, the idea of a community copyright. Although, if you look a little bit outside of copyright into the realm of industrial property, we're already getting quite used to the idea. We have already a community trademark, we have a community design, and we almost had, but we will one day have, a community patent. It is, however, becoming less taboo. There is an increasing interest in scholarly circles in a community copyright, and not only there, even, and this Tillman may not like, even EC Commissioner Vivian Redding, that's not yours, I believe, quote, I'll quote her anyway, believes that we have to start calling into question the territoriality of copyright protection in Europe. This is what she said last year somewhere in France. It is, at first sight, we believe, a very good idea. The potential economic advantages of a community copyright are undeniable. A community copyright would have community-wide effect immediately, would create a really single market for copyrights and related rights, both online and offline. A community copyright would enhance legal security and transparency, both for right owners and users, who would then no longer have to worry about what the law says in 25 member states, particularly when they are offering services online across the EU, and thereby greatly reduce transaction costs. Unification by regulation could also restore, and I think this is an important point, the asymmetry that is inherent in the current set of directives. The directives mandate basic economic rights, particularly the EUCD, but it only permits limitations. So you have to protect these rights, and you are allowed certain limitations. If you do it at the European level, if you create a truly European copyright law, you would give rights and limitations equal status, and thereby you could restore that equilibrium. Needless to say, but this becomes a bit technical, if we would seriously contemplate a community copyright, and again, it is for the distant future, we could not have national copyright survive side by side, because then you would create an extra layer of protection on top of existing systems, and that wouldn't bring us anywhere near a solution of many of the problems I just discussed. In this respect, I believe a copyright regulation would have to go a step further and truly preempt national systems. Like in the United States, 200 plus years ago, the federal system of copyright replaced the state copyright. We're very used to having a U.S. copyright at the federal level. We're very used not having to license services or products in 50 different states of the United States. A similar result would be achieved if we would do the same in Europe. I'm almost done. As regards limitations, I already mentioned them a few times. I believe a community copyright regulation would offer the attraction of having the limitations dealt with equal strength and urgency as the economic rights. But we do propose here a two-tiered approach, which would also take into account the principles of subsidiarity and proportionality. We do believe there is a remaining role there for the member states. The regulation itself should comprise a list of mandatory basic limitations, limitations no longer optional, as under the InfoSoc Directive, that would reflect in the first place the fundamental rights and freedoms enshrined in the European Convention on Human Rights, principles which are part of community law. Limitations of this kind should include rights of quotation and criticism, news reporting, parody, academic, educational freedoms, and what have you. And in addition, we believe limitations should also be covered that have a noticeable impact on the internal market or affect the rights of European consumers, all issues that should be dealt with at the EU level, such as the right of private copying, already mentioned in the last panel, the right to make temporary copies, etc. But that would still leave some room for member states. We would reserve a second tier in the form of an open norm leaving member states the freedom to provide for additional limitations subject to the three-step test that you all know about, I presume, and on condition that these freedoms would not have a noticeable impact on the internal market. So member states could provide for additional local limitations, not having a cross-European effect. With many more ideas about this regulation, but time is running out. Needless to say that for a community copyright regulation to be successful, a regulation that would be directly binding upon the citizens of the Union, it would have to meet the highest standards of coherence, consistency, transparency, and quality, more so than the existing directives. Apart from all the political hurdles that undoubtedly lie in the way of such a regulation, and I'm sure Tillman can list a few, this should make it a project of the very long term, allowing sufficient reflection and continuous input from all parties concerned, as well as from academic experts that have been left out of the discussions for too long at the European level. In that respect, we are, of course, very happy to be able to advise the Commission on these important issues. In this respect, we could have a look at the way European contract law is currently being developed in a constant institutionalized cooperation between the Commission and a group of qualified academic experts. Such an unhurried drafting process, which could start today and might lead to a result in, say, 10 years, could produce the technologically neutral norms that make up a transparent, consistent, and stable legal framework for many years to come. But I admit, musing on such a future community copyright in our current climate of Euroscepticism, in a current climate where discussions are dominated by the flavor of the day, is, as we say in the Netherlands, music of the future. That may be so, but the future of music and of software and of content in general and of the cultural industries that it supported has begun today. So I propose we start to work. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much, Bernd. Thought-provocative opening statement, and I see you never get tired of writing more reports, huh? A lot of work ahead, for sure. No, thank you very much. Thank you very much. So, Tillman Leader, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. Thank you also for the kind invitation to come to this conference here today, for the excellent organization since I arrived last evening. That is really the German efficiency model that we like so much. I think before I start, I want to go for full disclosure where I come from and what my relationship to copyright is. I have never in my life practiced copyright law. I have always been a competition lawyer, and I've mostly worked in competition policy. And in the time when there were a series of copyright-related cases going on in the European Commission, you all heard of Microsoft, of course, that is one of them, but there were previous cases. There is a case called IMS Health that also involved copyright. And then there is, of course, the famous McGill case. That is also a case that involves copyright. All of these cases I saw from the competition perspective and not from the copyright perspective. And all of these cases were, of course, about competition law curtailing the scope of copyright, because copyright was seen as a tool to dominate markets. In the McGill case, for instance, it was a tool to prevent the emergence of a new product because you had copyrights on previous components of that new product, and then you exercised your copyright, which was a copyright, strangely enough, over a program listing, to prevent a consolidated program booklet of several copyright holders' program listings. And then that was the McGill case. So competition policy said, no, this is an abusive exercise of copyright. You may not do so because it prevents the emergence of a new product, which is the consolidated program listing. So again, competition policy set, copyright and its scope needs to be reduced, or at least the exercise of copyright cannot always prevail. And then it moved on to the famous IMS Health case, the famous case about the pharmaceutical brick structure, where again, a competitor tried to develop a product based on an existing structure that was used to monitor prescription habits of pharmacists. And the competition policy regulator, the competition department, said, no, you cannot withhold this brick structure to your competitor and prevent him from developing a competing product. And of course, the major defense was, yes, but I have a copyright on that brick structure, and that is reflective of a serious effort and considerable investment. Why should I now be prevented from exercising it? And again, competition policy was used. If that would lead to the result that a new product could not emerge, to curtail the exercise of copyright. And the most controversial case in that series of competition and copyright interface is, of course, the Microsoft case, where again, the licensing of interoperability protocols, so interoperability in that case between the dominant desktop and the server storage products, which are also supplied by Microsoft, but also by competitors, was the core issue. The commission said you have to license the access to this essential desktop to competing producers of servers. You cannot monopolize the upstream or downstream, however you look at it, market of file servers or storage servers to yourself. You have to license an interface protocol, and I think we saw in the session this morning how important these interface protocols are. You have to license these to your competitor that their server products can operate with your dominant desktop. But of course, one obstacle to this licensing of the interface protocols to a competitor was that the company claimed that it had copyright protection on some of these interfaces, because some of these interfaces, of course, are protected under the standard of copyright, which is a protocol or any kind of software code is an artistic and literary works within the definition of copyright. And again, you have this interface between intellectual property, copyright, and competition on the market. And I looked at all of these cases from the other side of the fence. And at the end of this, I actually had to sort of speak to the public about these cases, because I was then the spokesman for competition policy for Mr. Monti. And I think I did such a lousy job at being a spokesman for Mr. Monti that the commission found the ultimate punishment for me. They sent me to the copyright unit. And that was in January 2005. Mr. Monti left the commission, and there I go. No more job prospects. You have to go to copyright, and you have to basically learn all the errors, and you have to sort of study all of these matters from the other side of the fence, and then you see the evils of your deed up to now, and hopefully you will become a reformed person from this experience. So there you go, January 2005, I look at copyright for the first time in my life, at least from a purely indigenous copyright perspective, and I find a lot of very, very interesting, or as I initially in youthful exuberance said, strange concepts in copyright, and especially in what Berndt has referred to as the harmonized copyright. And I want to tie in with what Berndt said, because there is some truth to it, that in this everlasting, never-ending quest to harmonize all the different copyright rules, we have created a body of rules at significant cost, obviously, to the legislative machinery, with significant time lag, obviously, because it has to first go through the European institutions, the Commission initiates, the Parliament takes it up, the Council, the Member States intervene, it gets adopted, and then you have a second set of legislative process at the national level. Then these directives, which give certain scope, need to be implemented at national level, and then the parliamentary process goes again. So it has come at a significant cost, It has come at a significant time lag. What was topical in 96 when the WIPO treaties were adopted was already changing in 2001 when the EU implemented it in the form of the Copyright Directive, and is certainly quite different in 2006 when the last member state has gotten around to implement this Copyright Directive and therefore indirectly to implement the 1996 WIPO treaties, 10 years later. And now I have to go back to WIPO, by the way, hopefully in the course of this year, that the community and its member states can actually then adhere to these treaties, because we have never done so up to now. So you see a considerable time lag, a considerable cost, but also a considerable opaqueness, if I may say so, in some of the formulations that were chosen in order to create what I would refer to as umbrella concepts of a harmonized European copyright. The most famous example of this, and I'm sure that Bernd, now I give it back to you this time, you won't like it too much, but the most famous example of a very, very open-ended legislation and a term which I never fully understood and which I begin to understand is the so-called making available right on the internet. That famous right that if you make things available on the internet at a time and place chosen by your consumer. And when I first came to the copyright unit and I read these directives and I asked the chief copyright lawyer in that unit, oh, what does that actually mean? Do you mean to say with that it's a kind of an on-demand service? Oh no, it's much more complex than this. And then it started. And I think Cornelia referred to this. Making available is a kind of hybrid between an uploading and I make it available, but the process of communication, of course, doesn't end just with the uploading. There needs to be then an element of pull, which is the consumer who downloads. And if you take the two together, then you get sort of the shape and the contours of the making available right. But God forbid, this is not on-demand delivery. That's much too simple. And I think we have a second example, and there I think Bernd and myself see eye to eye. That is the famous database directive. And I don't want to spend too much time on the database directive, but it is a wonderful example what harmonized legislation can produce. You had a certain standard of protection for databases, which is, as the Commission said in 96, the backbone of the internet economy. The whole internet is running on the back of databases. The whole thing in the internet is all databases, and it's all about these databases being interlinked. So instead of saying, okay, fine, that's an excellent thing, we said, we need to protect those databases, we need to put a copyright on them. There were, of course, protections for compilations and certain databases which had a very high threshold, meaning these databases had to be original. They need to represent a creative effort. And then there were other jurisdictions which said that we don't care about whether this is original or not. All we care about is whether you sweat it in producing it, because it is a painful process to collect all the data and to assemble it in the database and then make it available either in a CD or online. And that is the so-called sweat of the brow theory. As long as you suffered creating the database, you merit some sort of protection. Whether this is particular original or not, we don't care. So there you go. The community legislator comes in and says, this is impossible. There are two standards for the protection of databases. This impedes trade. This impedes the free movement of databases. This impedes competition. This impedes also, to be quite honest, the optimal protection of these databases because, of course, the directive was adopted to stimulate the production of databases, and the conventional wisdom at the time was that the more you protect, the more you stimulate the production of a particular good, which would otherwise not be produced. So we needed to create at EU level, and I can speak openly about this because this was long before my time, we needed to create this kind of harmonized protection for databases, reconciling the high level of originality that was prescribed by many jurisdictions with the sweat of the brow doctrine that was basically the result of the common law jurisdictions. And what do you think we did? And I give this to you as a simple question. One approach would have been to say, the non-original databases, all of those sweat databases, they don't need to be protected at all. And that is exactly what the United States did. There is a famous judgment, Feist. And Feist is about telephone directories. And the company who produced the telephone directory says, my telephone directory is a database. And the US Supreme Court said, that may well be, but that's a non-original database. You just put in a lot of names in alphabetical order. Okay, you match names and addresses, but that's basically all you do. That's not original. You had significant cost. Sell it and recoup your money by this, but we don't give you copyright. So one approach would actually have been to say, indeed, maybe in the rest of the community, we don't need to protect non-original databases, and then kindly ask those jurisdictions who have this kind of protection to get rid of it, because this form of protection impeded the free movement of physical goods at this time, because the databases were incorporated in CDs. And nowadays, you could make an argument, the free movement of services if the database is online. But no, of course, we did exactly the opposite. We created a new sui generis database right in order to keep the high level of protection, the high level of originality threshold on the continent, and to create an harmonized sweat of the brow. But we couldn't call it sweat of the brow, of course, because that's a common law concept. So we invented a new concept, which is sui generis. And sui generis databases need to be protected. So, as Bernd rightly points out, the tendency is, if you're confronted with a choice, whether to go up in the level of protection or to go down, you tend to go up. If two member states have a certain form of protection, the others don't, the others have to introduce it. It's a very devious argument I'm making here, but I'll come back to it in a minute, you will see. So it was harmonized, we created sui generis. Up to this day, I can't recite to you now how it's defined, but it's something about collection, assembly, and collation of data which require a substantial investment in these processes, and then you get protection against the extraction, all terms which are totally new to copyright law. Of course, nobody understood it, just like me and the making available right on day one when I entered the copyright unit. Nobody understood it. Courts were fighting endlessly what it all means. And finally, the European Court of Justice says, well, maybe we should interpret this very, very, very narrowly, because maybe we all don't know what it means, and maybe it leads to some sort of monopolization of the data in the database for those people who want to create downstream products. And there you go again. This is the McGill reasoning. This is the reasoning that sometimes copyright needs to be curtailed to prevent anti-competitive abuses. So I think that, in general, is a fair statement to make, that harmonization has always gone upwards. And it also is true what I said about the making available right and sui generis databases for the famous copyright levies. Copyright levies is yet another one of those things which some member states have and other member states don't have. So where do you think we should be going on copyright levies? Many people say the big scandal about copyright levies, and I briefly explained what it is, every time you buy recording equipment. For instance, it used to be easy when you had a tape recorder. Nowadays, the sort of scope of what a recording equipment is quite broad. Some jurisdictions, like I believe here in Germany, impose a copyright levy on a computer. So all of you who are tapsling away on your computers, rest assured you have paid a copyright levy for this computer, even if you will never, ever download any copyright protected works on this computer. Copyright levies are also being introduced increasingly in some member states on mobile phones with the argument, well, there is some storage capacity in that phone and you could theoretically download a bit of music if you can afford these super expensive mobile music services, and that's why we need to levy your mobile phone. Copyright levies obviously are imposed on a variety of consumer equipment, recording devices, the iPod, And every member state does a bit what they want. Sometimes it's relatively cheap. Here in Germany, you pay 256. In some other jurisdictions, you can pay up to 144 euro for one iPod in copyright levies. So again, having seen what happened with sui generis databases, some do it, some don't. The natural tendency is to all harmonize it, that everybody has to do it. What do you think should we do about copyright levies? Should we harmonize them that everybody has to do it and that all this equipment, even in those jurisdictions which do not have copyright levies, and that in Europe is notably the United Kingdom, Ireland, Malta, and Cyprus, so basically the common law jurisdictions. So it's in a sense, it's the other way around. This time, on the continent, we have these kind of special forms of, I wouldn't call a levy copyright, and the common law jurisdictions don't have it, whereas in the database example, it was the other way around. So obviously, the temptation is great to harmonize it. Three times that was tried, and three times that has failed. And I think that is where we have to learn a lesson. It was already in the original Green Paper, amongst many other new rights that we should introduce, we should also introduce a centralized system of copyright levies. And that has never taken off the ground. So maybe, I just invite you to think about this, and maybe we can have a debate on this afterwards, maybe we should learn from this endless upwards and upwards creation of new layers and layers of rights, and on the basis, and with respect to these new copyright levies, or with the challenge of how to deal with a heterogeneous system of copyright levies, maybe we should try something new. Maybe we should actually leave those common law jurisdictions in peace and not constantly lean on them to introduce copyright levies, but maybe we should look at the others and say, are these levies on all of this equipment really the right answer to the private copying that occurs? Now, I don't want to spend too much time on levies, but I just wanted to put them in the general context of the harmonization process and this endless lifting of the levels of protection, because I think they belong there, and I think that conceptually we have to start thinking about them in that context as well, and not just as an issue on whether this is a suitable system for compensating for private copies that you may do on your computers, but I know many people, including myself, who have to work so hard that we don't have time to constantly file share music or use these services and record music on our computers. We actually, or at least people like me, I actually use the computer to work, and then I'm tired and my eyes burn, and then I shut the thing. So, but I'm still paying the levy. So I think that is a bit of a stock-taking on the harmonization process. Obviously, this stacking of rights has caused a certain amount of licensing problem as well. That's why we did the 2005 licensing initiative. That is my first initiative. And I still, in spite of the criticism that I heard this morning, I still see some merit in this initiative. We can talk about this later as well. But the background to this initiative is exactly this upward harmonization in the field of copyright, in the digital environment, has created layers and layers of overlapping copyright and layers of collecting societies who are each responsible for a little part of it. There is a collecting society for the mechanical reproduction right, and we've seen this morning that every internet transmission is a mechanical reproduction. There is a collecting society for the so-called public performance right, and every time that you upload and then somebody else pulls this service and downloads, that is considered a public performance in its special emanation of this opaque making available right. And that is the problem also with these rights. You put layers on top of each other. You first have a reproduction right, and then the reproduction also leads to a performance, but it's not really a performance in the classical sense that we all understand, that you watch a streaming service or that you watch your TV, where you say, okay, this is performed to the public at large, but it's the public performance in its special emanation as a making available right, where basically you perform the work to one person only because that person has ordered this particular music or in the future this particular film on the internet. So all of these on-demand services, all of these services where the consumer pulls the content on an individualized basis, as it says in the directive, at a time and place chosen by him, they're not just the reproduction of the work, they're also, if you wish to characterize it like that, an individual performance. And that is, of course, at first sight, counterintuitive. If you buy music in the shop, you buy a CD. The producer of that CD, the phonogram company, has obviously to clear the reproduction right because he's pressed the physical object, the CD. But there's no public performance involved in you buying a CD at your local retailer. In the internet, if you do exactly the same, you download that music, there are two rights involved. It is, like in the other case, the reproduction right. But on top of that, in the internet, suddenly that this process is also considered the public performance in its special variant of the making available right. So instead, if you want to now, if you are an internet service provider, if you have a downloading service, or even in the future when we start, and I think that's a positive development, when we start licensing the peer-to-peer services, the fact remains that these services have to clear two rights, the reproduction right and the public performance right, as if this individualized shopping transaction was a public performance in the sense of watching TV. And that, of course, is complicated by the fact that in Europe, you have, in some jurisdictions, two societies for each right. So you have to negotiate with two societies, and then you have to negotiate for 25 territories, because if you're running a successful online service, you probably, contrary to what some collecting societies claim, you probably want to reach an audience which is a bit larger than one territory. I don't think I'm going to set up a peer-to-peer file sharing service and limit it to Belgium with 10 million people. That doesn't make a lot of sense. So I would probably disagree with some of the collecting societies and say no, music consumption is not something which is a national or a local phenomenon. Music consumption is probably international in scope, and indeed, the fact that you have layered rights plus layered territoriality makes it very difficult to offer legal music in Europe, and then we all wonder why everybody goes to the peer-to-peer network and gets it for free. Well, it is too complicated to offer it legally because of the two phenomena I mentioned, and that is the issue that the 2005 recommendation addresses, streamlining the rights management, streamlining the territorial management. Just because copyright is territorial doesn't mean that one licensor society cannot manage it for several territories in one transaction. But I think the review would have to look at the second part of this complication, the layering of rights. And I think that the introduction of a new layer of right, which is called making available, which was supposed to be sort of the element that underpins the digital economy, may have been at best neutral on the digital economy, and for the reasons I set out, maybe not particularly helpful. So that's layering of rights and territoriality. And the third point I want to make very briefly is about exceptions and limitations. And that ties in what I said in the beginning. I think we do have some very powerful exceptions and limitations to copyright, but they are not in the copyright laws themselves. They come from legal areas which are strictly outside of copyright. And that's the part that I can judge, because that's what I did before. I did the internal market and I did competition. And these are two powerful sets of tools which have, of course, a character of an exception and limitation, which is probably more powerful than any of the exceptions and limitations that you find in the code, which are, as Byrne said, optional in any case, except for the one about transient copying, which is, even that is controversial. What is transient copying? But again, it tries to at least address part of the problem that in the internet, every form of transmission is also a copy. So I think that exceptions and limitations, striking the right balance, we have a long line of jurisprudence which says that copyright may not be exercised in a way that stifles consumer access to goods throughout the internal market. We've had a long jurisprudence which says that all of these goods have to circulate freely in the internal market so that the consumer gets the best deal when he buys the products that incorporate content which is protected by copyright. And then we have competition policy. These are strong tools, but admittedly, one could think whether this kind of balancing between consumer access to works in the internal market or monopoly abuses or prevention of... Yes, I will conclude in a minute. Why can the copyright rules themselves not strike this balance? Why do we need the external areas of law to strike this proper balance? And I think that is also a thing that the review should look at. Is it actually appropriate that other disciplines of law strike the balance between access and copyright? Or should this balance be struck within the copyright rules themselves? So I think I've largely exceeded my time, and I've therefore been asked to stop, which I will do now promptly, and leave it open to debate. Thank you.
Thank you. A lot of food for thought again, and I hope, my only hope is, sorry for interrupting, that we really have time to discuss it at the end. So, Cornelia, please, and I would be grateful if we could probably be closer to the 20 minutes rather than the 30.
I will be very quick. My computer crashed 2 days ago. I don't have extensive notes anyway, so it should take like 5 minutes. I heard the word conspiracy theory. We should not believe that in Brussels the content owners have captured the commission. I would just like to put that in context. There are about up to 30,000 lobbyists in Brussels who lobby not only the commission, the council, and the European Parliament. All of those three institutions. You have around 700 MEPs, so you can eventually calculate how many lobbyists you have per MEP in Brussels. It's said that it is as much lobbyists now in Brussels as we have in Washington, where this is a much older phenomenon. Unfortunately, out of those many lobbyists, few are public interest NGO lobbyists. Most of them are industry lobbyists. And a little anecdote, I once visited Tilman Lüder in the commission, and I was waiting for a couple of minutes in the wall. They had an internal market newsletter for themselves there. And I was watching through this newsletter, and there was a picture of the head of office of IFPI in this commission newsletter, and I was just wondering, I have never made it to have my picture in a commission newsletter. So eventually, there is, you see, the powers are different. I will state four examples why the copyright directive is a failure for consumers. And after that, I will quickly talk a little bit about consumer protection law, and then I will eventually respond to the competition law aspect, if I still have the time for that. Now, first of all, the Copyright Directive implemented the WIPO treaties. As we heard, one of the features was the legal protection of technical measures. Now, the legal protection of technical measures amounts to leverage of the copyright protection and basically leads to the contrary of a harmonized internal market, because it can be used, and it is used, to help segment markets, be it by price segmentation or otherwise by regional segmentation. Definitely what happens nowadays, that when you go and upload and you go to a service, a music download service in the UK, where the prices are 99 pennies, you cannot access from the UK, for example, the same service in Germany, where the same music is priced differently. So for the consumer, nowadays there is no internal market in music download services. We already heard about the harmonization of limitation and exceptions. The directive has failed to deliver. It lists basically the national exceptions. This is a phenomenon we have very often in European legislation process, when in the course of the debate, in the process, after the proposal being adopted in the Commission, going to the Parliament and the Council, those two institutions cannot agree on a radical reform of their national laws, then very often, at the end, the compromise is leaving it to the member states. And that is what happened with the limitations exceptions. So everybody is able to implement the limitations he likes to implement. The problem with this is, at the same time, what it did is it didn't allow member states to go further than those limitations, which basically restricts member states to react to the need to newly balance this disbalance between right holders and the public interest. So while it failed to harmonize, it at the same time restricted member states to react to the development of societal requests. The fourth example is Article 644, where in on-demand services, and the Copyright Directive gives provides for a mechanism if the right holders do not allow those limitations to go and get them. There's different ways to implement that. However, in one specific limitation, the private copy limitation, private copy exception, if you like, this was excluded in on-demand services based on a contractual relationship between the right owners and the user, the consumer. Basically, this hinders any development of services which could be a value added within this exception, like information brokers, for example. And this is basically where we consumer lawyers think that consumers need some additional help. Now, obviously, there is two so-called a key set of laws, of European laws, which we could address. The one is the IP law, a key which will be recasted, reviewed. I think the reports of Bern are part of that. And the other one is the IP, the consumer protection law key, which at the same time will be reviewed now in the coming next years. There are a couple of directives which make up this consumer protection law. For example, the Unfair Terms Directive. Most of you might know the AGBG, the German Unfair Contract Act. And here, eventually, we can help consumers. Not only that, obviously, some of the end-user license agreements which are applied at the moment are already abusive, but we further think of the DRM, which is sort of a contract, if you like. It is technically the same. It's a term you have to obey to. And what we are thinking is that these codes are nowhere, there's no protection for consumers as to those codes. So what we would like to see is when this directive is reviewed, eventually not only to include terms, but also codes, so that you would have specific codes which are simply considered unfair. This is a new thinking, it's not yet developed, but we are trying just to address some of those imbalances which the copyright directive created. Another legislation could be information requirements, labeling requirements, which are set on a European level, and eventually also the Unfair Commercial Contract, the Unfair Commercial Practice Directive, if amended specifically to these cases. Now, this is all just our thinking. This must be developed, and we will have to see how the Commission and the other institutions react to these proposals. But at the same time, It was music to my ears to hear the proposal of Bernd, because we do believe that the real problem with the copyright directive is that it remains territorial, and basically the reason for many, many business models remaining territorial. So once this would be unified, you would have those Slovenians living in Germany who could obviously access any download service from Slovenia very easily. This said, just a short reaction to Tillman's competition law. I think the IMS Health case is sort of not resolved, still ongoing. Doesn't help much. McGill, it is said, I think it was Irish copyright law laying beyond that. And I read articles saying that this would have never decided the way it was decided by the European Court of Justice, basically giving a compulsory licensing to the company who created this new service, because it was a very, very peculiar copyright in Ireland. As to the Microsoft case, and here it demonstrates that competition law is a regulatory system which will not help us in the balance we seek in copyright law. Now, this was about interoperability, but only because Microsoft is a dominant firm. Now, we want to have interoperability whether the firm is dominant or not. It's simply something we seek to have in any of the applications for consumers to truly use all technical equipment they have in a way they want to have it, enabling them to enhance competitiveness by being able to switch when a better offer occurs. And that is basically the economic, the demand side of a competitive market, which needs the interoperability as a tool to be able to basically use its demand side power, fostering thereby the competitiveness of the internal market. So Microsoft case really just shows that we need much more than reducing us to saying, well, if there is abuse in copyright, competition law will solve it. No, we have to step in before that and see whether the copyright system still is in balance. And as a consumer organization, we say it's not, and it's time that there is something done. Well, thank you.
Thank you very much, Maya.
I will start talking while I connect this, hopefully. So, first of all, thank you for the invitation. I always like to come to Berlin to observe all the modern construction that was going on in the last 10 years. It's really amazing. And the other thing is, like, Wizard of Oz, it's really affectionate for me. Like, 3 years ago, I was here first time, and many things happened since connected with people who I met here. So I was invited here to, like, deliver sort of a national example or my observation of our national example of implementation. I come from Slovenia. We are a very small member state, and we just become member state recently. And with that, also with all those two factors, also our implementation procedure is really connected to. So I titled my short presentation, I promise, Copy, Translate, Paste. In fact, I'm going to talk about UCD implementation. Why copy, translate, paste? Because if I read our law, not as an objective observer, but somebody who knows how to speak, who can read Slovenian and read English, I would see my first observation that we've done just that. Basically, we copy, translated, pasted provisions, WEG provisions in the directive. So very, very short history would be that we become full EU membership in May 1st, 2004. That's the relevant historical information for this presentation. Short copyright history would be that we became independent in 1991, and only in 1995 we got first our national copyright law. Before, the Slovenia was member of one of the Republic of Yugoslavia, so we had that copyright law. But in 1995 we got new modern copyright law, and evaluated by the traditional copyright expert, it was really role model for copyright law at that time. And since then it was changed already three times, mainly because of implementations of national obligations and mainly because we had to implement European obligations. So what is the environment of the implementations that we what was the flavor of the environment or the conditions that implementation was taking place? First of all, we are continental European copyright system, with which I mean that we are very German oriented, that we would like be really looking what is Germany or Austria doing. Sometimes we even go and look what Switzerland is doing, and we would try to follow those examples. This also means that the natural right theory that is developed in continental European system, not as is developed in common law system, is really strong. So consequently, this means also that the moral rights are really that we really take high of moral rights. The other thing, consequently, is also that it's very author protective, meaning also that it's also very copyright holders protective. In addition to that, another an environmental feature of the process was that we were basically running for a membership ticket, which meant at that time that all that we had to implement directive before coming a full member state. So we didn't have this, or at least we didn't behave as we have the option that they have now in France, which is like a debate and many interests come forward and try to see what would be the best mode of implementation, at least as I see the process as is taking place in France right now. So running for membership ticket really means that a lot of time constraints and rapid procedures in parliament, and of course also obligations constraints. We sort of like to show off that we are like this A-plus student who implements obligations very quickly and very smoothly. So what was the consequence? The consequence was this copy, translate, paste implementation, which actually means no real social debate, rapid legislative procedures. We have a special provision in Constitution what really rapid legislative procedures means, but the practical consequence is that it was no real parliamentary debate, and to prove that, it's no amendments do the process. Like provision of technological measure, which is like really the most debated provision, I think, during the implementations. Elsewhere, it was not really seen as really problematic. To highlight my critiques, I will represent you two cases. First of one, it will be about reproduction right, or in fact about mandatory exception to this right. In our first amendment of our 1995 law, we had new definition of reproduction rights. So that meant that the drafters of the act of which implemented the future directive already envisioned they followed the debate on the level of commission, and they saw that it's already there, the new draft of new right, and they implemented it in law. But they forgot to implement also the new exception of new mandatory exceptions. So what really meant at that time was that we had new expanded definition of right of reproduction with no mandatory exceptions, which meant if I would, for example, publish my own work somewhere and that work would be on the server and I would like to download those work, I could actually sue the internet service provider for doing all those temporary copies that I could read my own work that I have my copyright on it. So it's really stupid mistake, maybe also stupid thing to always talk about this, because probably no serious judge would ever would never probably made said that this is against or whatever, but the problem is that it was never even an issue that this is the case, and it was there in the law for 3 years. So only in 2004, when the directive was already there, we all also enacted the new exception limitation only. Another example would be on legal protection, on the legal protection of technological measures. Already in this role model law in 1995, we had prohibition of sort of trafficking prohibition. This was in implementation of the software directive, where the provision was already there. The problem was that it was there for all works. It was not just for computer programs, but already in 1995, it was there for all works. This is sort of combination of anticipation of WIPO obligations with already obligations that were there in software directive. This is the behavior of really A-plus student who wants to implement every directive or every international obligations even before it's obliged to do. But what was really good in terms of devising a good technological protection provision, and before saying that was good, let me stress that I think that legal protection of technological measures as is devised on the European level or elsewhere is not a good thing. But if you have it, it's good to have it to protect only legal technical protection measures. So at that time, in 1995, we had that in law, before we had European Union obligations on the table. But with the implementation in 2001, we erased that. It was now in 2001, all technological protection measures were protected, meaning for CIR convention and for trafficking. It was no mechanism for exceptions, and for all works. It's not like now if you read the directives right, you have only trafficking provisions for computer programs, and for other works you have prohibition of circumvention and trafficking. But because we started this in 1995, it's still there. But so we are like, we took what was really sort of not very good solution, and we erased what was good solution, that meaning protection only of legally technological measures, because it was not in line with European Union directive. In 2004, still all technological protection measures protected. Now we have this mechanism for mediation, sort of keeping alive some limitations that are listed in the directive, still for all works. And one good thing, surprisingly, because before we would be evaluated sort of very author, copyright holder protective, different than other old member states, except maybe Italy in some respects, we have this private copy exception provision saying that private copy exception survives technological measures, at least on paper. But of course, mediation procedure is really non-efficient. So I will stop. I was basically criticizing Slovenia, what was doing, but I was trying to do that. I was doing that because I was trying to make a point that forcing member states that are just trying to become a member state and putting them on them obligations that they have to implement all laws very quickly, and not just copyright law, there is tons of laws, normally produces very bad results. But the bottom line point would be the directive was formatted too early in 1996 when it was started. Peer-to-peer didn't exist, at least not for general public. But then implementation, at least in Slovenia, was too rapid. And I understood Professor Hugenholz saying that the implementation took so long, 10 years, but the fact is that also like this rapid implementations is also wrong. So lesson to learn would be don't repeat that anywhere else, and long or even stronger lesson would be let's design something better than Information Society Directive. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And now let's quickly open up and have an open discussion. Please, first question. And please introduce yourself at the beginning. Takes a second.
Okay. Andrea Glorioso from the Polytechnic of Torino, Italy. I would like to thank all the panel for this extremely interesting set of views and a refreshing set of views on the goods or evils of harmonization or lack thereof. I would like more precisely to make two small questions, if I'm allowed, one to Professor Hugenholz and one to Mr. or Dr. Luder. I don't know the title. And Professor Hugenholz has mentioned soft law as a possible tool, as the preferential tool in the short run to change what we have currently. And it's not clear to me how effective that would be, given that the fact it is soft law. And the question, or rather a mix of a comment of a question for Mr. Luder, is I understand the European Commission, in general the European institutions, are aiming to change the set of laws on copyrights. How should we trust as citizens the European Commission? This is not something I'm asking for myself, but I'm asked by other people. Why should I trust the European Commission in doing so when I think about the revision of the database directive? The report that came out basically said, we know that the database directive is broken, or rather we can't really say that the database directive does anything good, but it would be too much of a mess to change it, so we're not going to change it. Given this condition, how can a European citizen trust the European Commission to do anything good in its revision of copyright, or for that matter, any other kind of law? But I'm specializing copyright and database in copyright and related law, so I won't touch other fields. Thank you.
I think I got the easy question, but it's not so easy at all, actually. It's a very good question. What can we achieve with soft law? I mean, isn't soft law a bit soft on the soft side? Yes, it is. It is soft by its very nature. In fact, technically speaking, soft law is no law at all. There is no place for soft law in the European legal system, except that recommendations are indeed mentioned somewhere in the back of the EC treaty. So formally, if you say soft law, we can all ignore it, you would probably be right. But you're a lawyer and you know that soft law does play a role in our legal system, not only at the European but also at the national level, and can in fact have a normative effect. What it cannot achieve is a revolution. If you really want to change fundamentally certain characteristics of the existing acquis, soft law is not the way to do it. But if you look at certain inconsistencies that could be cleared up by some statement of a European Commission in soft law, I think that would help a lot and take the pressure away from the system. You may remember that only a few years ago there was a serious plan to consolidate the acquis, all the directives, put them into one perfect instrument and smooth out all the differences. that was a more ambitious time for the Commission. I think we should immediately abandon ideas like that. It'll take another 10 years, and then you have smoothed out a few commas. This is not what we want. Soft law can do that. Soft law could explain, for instance, that the exception for transient copying that currently only applies to normal content but not to databases and software, that in fact would also cover that. That might have a normative effect. It's not 100% bulletproof, but it might, as I say, allow us to focus on the more serious issues, the really serious things you, of course, will have to achieve in hard law. I think I've said enough about that.
Dr. Leader.
Thank you. How does this work?
It's working.
Press a button. Okay. I will answer your question immediately, but I cannot resist the temptation to say something about soft law. I think that soft law, if it responds to a popular demand and if it addresses an issue which everybody is thinking about, can actually be much more powerful than some obscure directive which addresses some esoteric issue which nobody cares about. And what I want to say with that is that I think everybody has seen the territoriality-based problems that we have in the EU. Everybody sees that for our online kind of licensing, we have obstacles which other larger homogeneous jurisdictions don't have. Everybody knows the story that Apple's iTunes was available in the US 2001 onwards and was only introduced in Europe on a territory-by-territory basis, first in the UK in 2003, a bit later in Germany in 2003, then in a second round in the Benelux in 2004, and then finally in the Nordic countries and in the Mediterranean countries in 2005. So everybody could see, literally, that there is a problem with territorial rights management. And if you then adopt a well-targeted piece of so-called soft law, it addresses something which is visible, and even if it has no legally binding teeth, it is almost a moral imperative to respond to it. And I think that is what happened, and maybe not with the result that everybody would like, in the sense that we have individual choice. This individual choice, and I can see the point that Cornelia is making, this individual choice can also be exercised by big music publishers, and they can create a rather powerful collecting society if they say, for our online rights, we will mandate you to administer our national rights, but all of them are administered in one bundle. So what we've created basically with that recommendation is that one society who is chosen by the right holder will give you in one transaction the bundle of licenses that you need. And that is an approach which probably will then lead to a pan-European license without actually changing the copyright laws. But the downside of this is indeed, as Cornelia has pointed out, that if a few major music publishers exercise that choice, it will create a powerful EU collecting society, or maybe two or three of them. And that is the kind of balance that I think we've seen. But on the other hand, and that is the second thing I want to say about soft law, these people are more creative than the bureaucrats. These people also see these problems, and that is why now at least one music publisher has developed a non-exclusive model, where they say, you can have our rights for administration throughout the EU, but we don't give it to you alone, because we don't want you to be some sort of a monopoly. We give it to several collecting societies, and then they can license particular end users in competition that need this license. And all of this, to be quite honest, could not have been foreseen by two bureaucrats sitting at a desk writing a piece of legislation. And in the soft law, if you do it a bit open-ended, you leave a lot of scope for these kind of developments, and some of the remedies, which as a legislator we didn't think about initially, will come up by the people who implement the system. So in that sense, soft law, if it responds to popular demand, and if it's sufficiently open that people can self-correct inherent flaws of any legislative approach, which would then have perpetuated the flaws, I think is the right approach, and we're going to continue along those lines. On the report of the database directive, I kept that to the last because it's almost funny. That is one of those things which you probably do once in your life and then you learn the lesson. And so again, we go back to 2005, the ambitious year, the first year. We did the online recommendation, and indeed, and I'm very happy that you read this evaluation report on the database directive, long overdue. So we finally did it in 2005, and we came to the conclusion, for those of you who didn't read it, that the introduction of this sui generis right, so this new layer of copyright protection for the non-original databases throughout the community, has not led to an increase in production of databases, has not led to an increase in the dissemination of knowledge incorporated in these databases. Quite to the contrary, actually, compared with the United States, which do not protect sui generis databases, the European production has actually plummeted, has fallen. Plummeted is a bit exaggerated, but has certainly fallen. So the link between economic activity, the link between dissemination of knowledge and certain forms of copyright is more than contestable. But now comes the reality check. So we did the report, December 2005, and then you go and say, what do you do about this directive? And one logical conclusion would have been, we will repeal this part about the directive at least, which introduces this new layer of rights. And we abolish it. But then you got the same old arguments over again. That means that the United Kingdom can reintroduce sweat of the brow, and in the continent, they don't reintroduce sweat of the brow. Or they introduce something else. Oh God, the harmonization effect is lost. So leave the directive in place, because even if it didn't achieve anything in real terms, it achieved harmonization. So is harmonization a goal in itself? I believe not. But, well, there's a final argument. I'm hesitant to say it, but okay, fine, I'll say it here. Maybe you don't need to propagate it too much outside. I know this is not a Chatham House thing, so everything is public. In any case, I'll say it anyway. So the biggest killer argument at the end of the day was, well, you know, it's on the code book, and you can't prove, so that to us, to the copyright unit, you can't prove that it's harmful either. You can't prove that it has... The directive cannot prove that it has a significant effect on the production of databases and on the dissemination of knowledge, but you can't prove that it's harmful for these things either. It's basically a harmless piece of legislation. So there is the new, better regulation standard. As long as it doesn't harm, it can stay on the code book.
Further questions?
Okay, I have a short comment and a question, actually. Like, the comment is to...
Please introduce yourself.
Please. Oh, my name is Paul Keller from Creative Commons in the Netherlands. The comment is more in the comparison you made between the database right and the private copying levy, and you both described them actually as layers of rights. And I don't see where, like, the private copying levy is actually a layer of right, an extra layer of rights. It's actually, like, a way of exercising your rights. And for me, the more interesting question is actually, especially since you position it between a choice between private copying levy and DRM controls, which system is open and fairer in the end? And the question is actually, I had another one, but you pointed me to something more interesting in your reply to that soft law question. If you say there is by now one of the major music publishers which does non-exclusive licensing to or gives non-exclusive licenses to a collecting society or non-exclusive assignment of rights to a collecting society, don't you believe that individual artists shouldn't be able to do the same, which would solve one of the problems we as Creative Commons have with the collecting societies?
If it's on the same topic, you may... Okay, different topic. So could you... Please repeat your first question very shortly.
Oh, that wasn't really a question. There was a comment that the database right.
Yeah.
The database right and the private copying levy, it's not both a new level of rights.
Maybe I should briefly answer those two. Very briefly, I absolutely agree with you that copyright levies are not rights. They are actually compensation once you've lost your right, because you, in the private sphere, cannot exercise your right. And they're also not remuneration in the sense of when you play a phonogram on the airwaves, that you don't have an exclusive right, but you have a right to remuneration. There are neither a right nor a remuneration under international treaties. In my opinion, they are just compensation payments for those people who cannot exercise the rights because of the private sphere. And in that sense, indeed, there is a difference between the database right and the private copy levies. But the phenomenon of harmonization, of course, stays, because even if it's not a right, people seem to think that this form of compensation in itself has to be harmonized. And there were three attempts to do so, and they all failed, because there is no acceptance that you should exercise copyright in the private sphere, and there is no acceptance that everybody who uses this equipment for a lot of purposes should be paying those levies, even if they don't, when they use their computer, do a copy of protected works. So they're not rights, but the harmonization debacle remains, because some member states have them and some member states don't have them, and they're somehow linked to copyright, although they are not copyright. Your second question, non-exclusive licensing, absolutely. If the publishers can do so, the individuals can do so as well. And if you want to give a non-exclusive right license only for certain forms of use, i.e., for instance, only for digital transmissions, you should be able to do so as well. And this is exactly where, as you totally rightly point out, the collecting societies step in and say, no, you cannot do this. You have to give us all of your rights as a bundle, and then we will manage all of your rights for you. That means the collecting society says, we want to have the public performance right. We want to have the television right, the broadcasting right. We want to have the internet right. And we will manage all of these rights as a bundle, and you cannot withdraw, for instance, only the digital transmission rights in the widest sense that we heard this morning, and leave in the public performance rights. And that is a big obstacle, and that is what this recommendation actually recommends. Right holders, be it corporate or individual, should have the choice to withdraw defined categories of their right and entrust them to somebody new, and for on a pan-European basis. And I'm very happy that you say this, because before you condemn this recommendation as yet another conspiracy to foster big business and to give a typical Brussels thing, to give the big right holders all the power, I have heard now from three independent sources that actually the Creative Commons and alternative licensing schemes see this recommendation also as a benchmark for their activities, because it allows what Creative Commons wants to achieve, the unbundling of the rights. You can actually withdraw particular rights from the collecting society, give it to another one, and others you can leave in.
But it seems to just a
only. Very, we very have only quick 7 minutes left and other questions.
I would think there is some need for assistance for the consumers, because apparently big music publishers, they will be taken by some collecting society. The individual artist needs some kind of like support, administrative support, or what kind of support ever to get accepted, because otherwise they just say we don't take you. In that case, where somebody controls, I don't know, 20% of the repertoire, that's much easier to negotiate.
You want to add something, Bernd?
I have a very direct follow-up question, which is about how the power of soft law. Now, imagine that there are these artists who want to license some of their music for under Creative Commons, and they are bound by these very tight provisions of the adherence of the standard adherence contract with their local collecting society. Now, if these societies do not change their mind, having read your recommendation or having heard and seen this webcast, can they complain somewhere? Can they go to the commission? Will they do some? Can you do something for them? Because this is an urgent question, of course. It's
I think
very
that,
much on the table yes. now.
I think that we all, but there is already a case on this. It's the Banghalter. You remember that group? And they wanted to withdraw their rights, and the SACEM didn't allow them to do so. And they said, no, you have to leave all of your rights in there, because if you, as a very popular group, at least at the time, withdraw your rights, you are endangering your financial equilibrium. And if you do so, that would be in of the SACEM. And if you then withdraw your internet rights or your digital rights and leave the rest in SACEM, SACEM gets to do the lousy job and you get to pick the cherries. and that was analyzed as an abuse of dominant position scenario. Under these exceptional circumstances, it was accepted that they could actually... No, actually, it was not accepted. I revised myself. The commission held in that case that you could not prevent them from withdrawing the digital transmission rights and leaving the rest in there. And the burden of proof was on the SACEM that their financial equilibrium would be endangered if Banghalter and his friend left. And the SACEM then had to prove that this was a danger for their equilibrium. So indeed, there are remedies. This is a competition remedy. There are remedies that you say that the recommendation is not fully complied with, or that it's not, that its spirit is not respected. There is nothing to comply. It's a recommendation. And that ultimately we, in cooperation with other people in the commission, will think about the follow-up. But one follow-up is competition law.
Can I, Vera, just before I just, I want to add one little tiny thing. Now, you have, basically, Birk did not only condemn it, but we asked a lot of questions, and we just think that it's not thought through thoroughly for a couple of reasons, which we have stated before. Now, one of them is that you have this contractual freedom of the right holders to choose the CRM he wants to choose, based on criteria, for example, Shaw specific, or the remuneration scheme, or anything else. But on the other hand, if you introduce contractual freedom, this usually goes for both sides. So the question is, can collecting rights societies prevent some right holders to give their rights to that CRM, refuse this contractual relation? And this obviously will be important in the case of those of the big majors, basically, who have the recording companies. We very often are vertically integrated. They might not have an interest to have other right holders in there. So there are key questions which remain open. And obviously, again, you can deal with these things once one of those new CRMs will have created a dominant position. Then competition law steps in, and eventually then they are forced to contract genre-specific music. But until then, that is an open question.
Okay, we have time for one last question, and this question will be asked by Vera Franz, please.
Yeah, I'm Vera Franz from the Open Society Institute. I'm Vera Franz from the Open Society Institute. I have one question for Mr. Luder that's about exceptions, limitations, or also called user rights. And I was glad to hear that you favor a strengthening of those rights, for example, also by including competition law more into the body of copyright law, which, for example, I think Article 8 and 40 of TRIPS are trying to do. Now, pointing to the future that Bernd laid out, that would envisage a copyright community law or act, would this mean, by extension, that we would have minimum mandatory exceptions limitations in such a community act? And further, would that also mean that potentially one could have minimum mandatory exceptions limitations or user rights on a global scale? Which, by the way, is not a new idea, but currently on the agenda, I believe, at WIPO in Geneva. Thanks.
I think especially that your last reference to WIPO is very important, because one thing that I failed to say, but which I wanted to say, is that we shouldn't look at this just as a European thing, or we shouldn't look at this just as a United States European thing. What have we achieved? How have we done the implementation of the WIPO copyright treaties in the US, Digital Millennium Act versus Copyright Directive? There are many other jurisdictions out there which also have found different solutions. And to be quite honest, if I talk in the WIPO to some of the colleagues from other jurisdictions, they are puzzled about how we did exceptions and limitations. They think that maybe this is a good idea, but it sounds terribly complicated. And of course, they're especially puzzled about sui generis database protection, but that's another story. So we should look at these things in a global context and not forget that it's not just Europe and the US. And if you look at it on a global context, then indeed the questions of the exceptions, access to knowledge, comes up. And then I think there are two methods, and this is something which we will have to wait with great anticipation for Burns' report. But I can see two ways to achieve that. Either you look at the scope of copyright, and you say not all of, and that is what I was saying with the layering of rights, not all forms of internet transmission need to be covered by at least two, if not potentially even more, layers of copyright. Maybe that could be weeded out a bit, and then, of course, many of the exceptions at the moment only exist because there is a broadly defined reproduction right. And if you define the right very, very broadly, then you need to have a lot of exceptions because any kind of normal transmission behavior is suddenly a copyright-relevant act, which it shouldn't have been in the first place. And the second approach is to have these broad rights and have exceptions. Now, you've seen from my answer that I have a certain sympathy to also look upstream, that we should say copyright is really about making a copy or having a public performance, but it cannot be both always at the same time. And if you then streamline these kind of rights upstream and make them more operational, you don't need all of these exceptions. Library exception is largely there, for instance, because any kind of use is, again, a reproduction. But indeed, I think that exceptions and limitations, to answer your question very precisely, are being reviewed. And I think that we would like the Hugenholz study and then maybe other stakeholder consultations to tell us, is the problem that there are two broadly defined exclusive rights, which maybe even commercially don't make sense, or is it the problem that we need to have certain group-specific exceptions, people basically who do research or libraries. But to give you a final example, when you look at WIPO and the Broadcasting Treaty, you have a classical example of there is a new layer of right for broadcasters. And the narrower you define that, the less exceptions you need. It is only because those rights are introduced in such a broad way that you suddenly realize that many, many everyday activities are covered by the reproduction right. I give you the example of time shifting, platform shifting. So time shifting, you record something for later viewing. Well, you're only going to look at it once, maybe not at the time it was programmed, maybe later. But why should that additional reproduction be a copyright-relevant act? Platform shifting, you shift from one device onto another. Well, at the end, you're just going to look at it as many times as you would have looked at it if you only had one device. You just look at it on another device. And all these kind of examples are maybe more a question of definition of rights than real exceptions.
Thank you very much. Unfortunately, we're running short in time, out of time, actually. And since it's almost impossible to summarize such a rich panel, let me conclude with only three very brief remarks. In my view, I think we have reached some kind of broad agreement, or rough consensus is probably the better term. First, harmonization a la EUCD leads to a race to the top as far as the protection of copyright holders' interests are concerned. By doing so, it has created significant asymmetries and imbalances that need to be addressed and fixed in areas such as exceptions for legitimate uses, but also the question of fair, adequate compensation mechanisms, as well as the many thorny issues surrounding DRM. Here, some of the keywords would be interoperability, transparency, as well as the interface with exceptions. The third, I think, area where we started an interesting discussion and where we have some agreement on is that it may be helpful to look in areas outside of copyright law, to look beyond copyright law and go into much more detail whether, for instance, competition law increasingly, for instance, may be helpful to address some of the problems identified and mentioned before, or whether whether consumer protection law may be another promising approach. Please
give a hand to our terrific panelists and thank you for your attention. Thank you.
Thank you.